Welcome to Whistleblowers.
You might ask yourself why the orders we showed in part one are so important for our fall of the Cabal. Well, you know the expression, know thy enemy? In order to understand the magnificence of their elite plan and the magnitude of their evil intent, we must first identify whom we are dealing with here.
We're talking about King's Cross, Sydney, New South Wales, and you're listening to episode 2 of The Fall of the Cabal. We'll come to Jennifer Stone shortly and we'll ask her, what has all this got to do with Sydney, Australia?
Believe that all of these orders and movements were separate entities that came and went in history, independently and rather harmlessly, then you will most certainly not understand nor believe the true identity of the Cabal. You will miss the fact that we find ourselves at the final stage of their master plan. And if you don't fully comprehend in which danger we find ourselves, you will not know what to do at the moment supreme. That is why we make this documentary, so you can wake up, see through all the lies.
Well, there we go. No more lies. Good morning, Jennifer Stone.
Good morning.
And the name of your book is The Fall of the Cabal.
Yes. I actually gave it that name because I decided that's what's coming down. And no one had worked out the heart. So the fall of Cabal is the Cabal is sometimes known overseas as the deep state in America. It's not well known as that in Australia. I have used the links in history as, the notorious outlaw gang that was formed in 1920. But this gang linked before that in history to the position that I once searched to 1860. And even it was marked before that to the Russell name.
So this morning you've come in here and, bristling again as usual. You've been getting your research out and there was topics I wanted to talk about, but you said, no, we need to pin this down. It's time to get the message out. And you mentioned one name. You always come in with a name to start with, and this name was Sir Wayne Martin, founder of the Pink Pussycat Club and friend to the stars.
Yes. Well, Sir Wayne Martin, you started to think, sir? And how does that link in? But if anything comes down, my research links to the pink pussycat. See, in the Bible, there is no cat. But the Muslims link into Muhammad had a cat on his lap. And this is the cat and mouse game. So I write about the mouse, the rats, the fights between the mice on the ground in King's Cross. They're fighting over little pieces of streets and that on their drug run. But really, all their money goes on their drugs. Rodney Goldie Atkinson said it all. He said, there's only one guy that makes money.
And for those that don't know, poor old Wayne Martin, as he was known, not a pretty common name, Wayne Martin, co-founder of the Pink Pussycat Club. It's a strip club, a very famous strip club that existed in Sydney. And he was a very good friend of Frank Sinatra, and he was a notorious King's Cross underworld figure. He died at the age of 89 last year. Martin chauffeured and looked after Sinatra when Sinatra visited Australia. The title Sir Wayne, with appropriate documentation, is said to have been bestowed upon him as a mark of thanks by Frank Sinatra, the legendary crooner. He was also an associate of underworld figures Abe Saffron and Jack Rookland. So we know Frank Sinatra had ties to the Italian mafia. Wayne Martin was born in New Zealand, but you were saying that there's links. He arrived at Woolloomooloo and King's Cross became his stomping ground.
Yes, and it's interesting because the master that I found back in 2011, he came 40 years before to Woolloomooloo and he said all he knew was to come to King's Cross and to find Bill Bayer, and he had a job. And it was an interesting thing because in those 40 years of his drug dealing of 5K a week, he never got caught and bragged about it until he met me. And then he got caught. And then he got caught again. And at the moment, he's still before the courts. So that keeps him tied up. And it keeps them to be honest. They, you know, a lot of the drug dealers in King's Cross are on Centrelink. And though the public might know about it, they don't have to do job searches, don't have to do anything, because their drug addiction stops them being functioning. And they get a doctor's certificate. It's treated like a sickness through our medical system. But the sickness is man-made. The sickness is giving them money because they have money to buy their drugs.
Okay. There you go, folks. Dazzling start. Hollywood links. Night and day. So Wayne Martin, he tasted the club night club scene in King's Cross and he made some very high-level friends. He became friends to a fellow by the name of Benjamin Bugsy Segal, an American mobster. Segal was known at the time as one of the most infamous and feared gangsters of his day and was also a driving force behind the development of the Las Vegas Strip. Wayne Martin returned to ask Abe Saffron, who was the proprietor at the time of a highly successful Roosevelt nightclub in King's Cross, as well as a string of pubs. He said to Abe Saffron he'd like to launch Sydney's first strip club and call it the Pink Pussycat, based on the Las Vegas style nightclub. And so it was established with Abe's blessing in 1958. But there's more to this story than dazzling girls and Jen's grabbing the microphone.
Sorry about that. In 1948, Abe Saffron linked to the same building that the Pink Pussycat was started in 1958. In 1948 was the transfer from Tilly Devine to Abe Saffron. Now, you've got to know that Tilly Devine was the madam of the brothel that we're talking about. But back then, she wasn't moving the major drugs. It was allegedly her husband, Big Jim Devine. So then Abe Saffron came into the picture, but his wife was married and kept at home and he was only a father like 3 days a week. And then on the other days, he had a girlfriend that liked the ballet. And his kids, as you read about them, they don't really classify him as a great father. There's always this hidden undertone and leaving books behind, as Alan Saffron has, to expose who really murdered Juanita Nelson.
Very good and interesting. It does go into some very dark corners here, this story, but we have to remember, particularly for young listeners, that, you know, I've spoken to elderly people who have passed on now, but they talk about the cosmopolitan days of King's Cross, and cocaine was everywhere. In fact, I think it possibly was legal at some point. It was in
yes.
Coca-Cola, the drink.
Yes.
And so this demonising of certain drugs like marijuana and cocaine over the years to now almost obsessional proportions amongst the wider community, the people that were alive during this time would have been laughing at where it's gone to today. But, you know, Sir Wayne Martin, his terrace house in Paddington became one of the hottest party spots for stars, gangsters, strippers and friends. I wonder where that terrace house was. Sounds like a great time. He told one reporter, "One night I bring Frank Sinatra the mail that Ray Charles has just been pinched for drugs in America. Frank was just out of the shower with a towel around him and he sits on the lounge and leans back. Well, my jaw dropped. His valet says, now you know why they call him
The King.
Yes, then. The King. If you start to think about why would anyone call themselves the King? Elvis Presley was known as the King. And people would write about his alleged drug use. And, you know, but then in history, there's some say that he actually rolled over and was exposing them under the CIA to catch the big boys for the drug running. So there's two sides. They see the drugs moving through the clubs. but they don't say anything, you know, until they really get caught up and realise that these drugs are ruining my life. I don't want it to ruin somebody else's. In King's Cross, some say Frank Sinatra came allegedly to pick up bags of money to take back for the mafia. Now, that's all, you know, it never got caught. You don't know whether it's true or not. It's just the whispers that happen. But it's an interesting period in King's Cross where everything was bright lights and bushy-tailed and, you know, people spent their weekends, you know, their nights off to go to the Cross, to have a good time, you know, to pay $20 to enter some of the clubs. But now we've got the clubs gone and the drug scene still raging and the police still have no idea how to combat it, except the problem is it's the patterns and how it comes about. They haven't exposed the heart of the operation, expose what holds them together, and then that makes them fly apart. There's then no links. It'll be easier to...
Very interesting. We've been looking at some footage on the internet of police raids of various crime gangs and some of the higher level sort of raids. There's always a camera there, and we were saying just how relaxed the police look and the perpetrators that are being handcuffed and arrested, just how relaxed everybody looks. And Jen said, look at that guy, he's an older guy with soft hands. And Sir Wayne Martin was described the same way. He was a kind and gentle man. He went from being an orphan stowaway to a role model to his two grandsons. So there is a system here, and that's what whistleblowers and Jen Stone is trying to bring to light and keep this type of investigative journalism going, is it's never gets to the top. We see on the news every night all the poor, suffering people at the bottom, and no doubt drugs today have changed. There's some far more volatile and far more dangerous drugs on the scene than what it was like in Frank Sinatra's day. But nevertheless, the same structures, the same systems exist, and that's what Jen's book, The Fall of the Cabal, is about, and that's what today's podcast is about. And you said to me, you never actually originally used the word mafia, but then you researched and you observed a lot of things happening in King's Cross, and you decided, yes, this is just like a mafia operation.
Yes, families. In Australia, it's 9 families at the top of the pyramid, but the mafia in Calabrian, overseas, they link to 5 families. So at each of them, you know, and then I linked into the Russell Trust that allegedly, I believe, was taken over by the Rothschilds and the Bush family in 1948. And the link to the Russell name, where the premises of the brothel should be. And you keep saying, well, why haven't they searched it? You know, that's a question that people have asked me time and time again. Why haven't the police figured it out? But you think in the Woods Royal Commission, they were given, it was proved in it in the reports, $14 million to the police. And Roger Rogerson only says there's only 20 bad cops, not 500 detectives that are on the payroll. So you start to figure out the system. And there's got to be a system because it works like clockwork. Every afternoon the drugs are in King's Cross and every night they never run out.
We just heard Frank Sinatra's song, Night and Day. Every day and every night in King's Cross, the drugs come in, the people come in, the drugs go out. Like a mafia operation. So Jen, this is where it gets interesting. You've done a lot of observation as well as research and reading, and you've sat and you've walked.
Yes.
And you've done a lot of the legwork required to back up what you're researching. So this is what I think listeners will find interesting. Tell us about the, you know, being on the main street of King's Cross, sitting in cafes that were there at the time of these events. You mentioned the King's Cross Hotel and a couple of the nightclubs, and a fella by the name of Billy, King's Cross Billy. Let's start with him.
Well, Billy was a person that I'd see standing in a doorway as I'd walk up to the shops, you know, do your groceries and whatever. And I'd make an effort to go out about 4 o'clock and have a look at the street. 4 p.m. in the afternoon. Not 4 a.m., but 4 p.m. And I started to think, well, the drugs were coming in. How would they be there?
So you would sit and you would watch, and day after day, then you met Billy and a breakthrough happened with this 4 p.m. look and nod.
Yes. So what he would do was stand in a doorway and he would look, check the strip for coppers. So the undercover detective at the moment, he's still the same one, Detective Hyde, Marty Hyde. He wears in winter this football jersey. It's the same football jersey every day. So though it might stink, he also is someone you only have to glance for. Because they're not looking for a face, they're looking for this football jersey. And I told the cops, you know, he stands out. He can't catch him because he's wearing the same clothes.
So the 4 p.m. look and nod was to look for a police car or this guy in his football jersey. What would happen then?
Okay, so then he would look across the road. So at a few positions across the road on Darlinghurst Road, he would look at. And then he'd do his look up and down the strip, and then he'd nod his head. It was a definite nod, and then they'd run. They'd run from, you know, Porky's across into Love Machine.
So people would move, you said.
Yes.
So what Jen noticed was after the nod, there'd be a movement of people. And people would move quickly, and people would move intently too. And so they would move initially into these buildings, some of these buildings. What names were they again?
Well, at the time when I was doing the research, 2011, it was Porky's, Love Machine, Showgirls, Stripperama, then the Astoria Hotel.
So groups of people would go in, is that right?
Okay, one person. But what I noticed, I used to sit in the cafe opposite Love Machine and watch. And really, I was just watching the strip. I wasn't doing anything, having my coffee and reading up on the papers. I wasn't really checking for anything.
No.
Then I noticed on a regular basis, I'd see one guy walk up the steps to Love Machine.
Yeah.
And after that, wouldn't be very long, there'd be like 20 guys. You'd see them gather.
Yep.
Once I started to realise, they would gather, they'd stand out the front in bits and pieces.
They were ready, and up to, you know, say 20 people would go up the same stairs in the front of the building.
Yes, in the front of the building. So they'd be seen on the cameras,
yeah,
right? And then you'd never see them come out that way. But they'd come out dribs and drabs. It'd take them a while, maybe an hour. But I used to think they were dividing the drugs up. Like, that'd take a while.
That would take a while. So they'd go into, say, in this case, the Love Machine.
Yeah.
And so they'd come out in later when it's all been done efficiently and quickly into Kellett Street, which is a back street.
Yes, Kellett Street.
But they wouldn't come out together or in groups.
No. And there would be working girls up there at the time. So, you know, people would think that that was okay. It was a good cover.
Yep.
But
busy time of day for that type of trade.
But if I... The patterns. So I go back to the patterns. This same pattern I found down in Crown Street. I found it down in Darlinghurst, right down the bottom, near the museum there. It was a pattern I saw. So they don't just go to the Love Machine. They would, over a period of time, swap it and go to Porky's or Stripperama Club. I've seen the shutter at Stripperama open up at the exact time that the dealer's coming across the road. And he'd walk in and under, and then you never see the back entrance. You never see him come back out that way. You know, there's always another way to get out of the premises.
And from there, you know, you did a little bit of research down in that street. obviously they'd go on foot, or they'd have their way of dispersing out into the night or the afternoon, it was.
And one of the days when I was around there, I actually rang an ex-detective from King's Cross that I had found, that I talked to, and I said to him, there's this girl following me. The girl would have been in her 50s. I was younger than that at the time. And she looked haggard. She was old. She'd been well worked. And I'm thinking, why is she following me? And he said, just get out of there. He said, because if they've put someone on the back of you, they know you're bringing them down.
Right. So we have to be careful, Jen. You mentioned that same cafe. Someone else, a great friend to the people of Sydney, the well-known underworld figure Bill Bayer, would also drink coffee in the cafe across the road from the Love Machine. That was interesting.
He became... it would be interesting whether he owned it or who owned the building. That's something that's gone through my mind, because we had a fire in King's Cross and it happened in the Love Machine. And then it got all decked out and then he came to King's Cross.
All right, here's a little bit on Bill Bayer for those that don't know who he is.
King's Cross has walked free from Sydney's Silverwater Jail. Bill Bayer was released on parole after serving a minimum 15-year sentence for trafficking heroin and cocaine in the mid-90s. Ordered not to return to King's Cross, the 55-year-old might just join the family's fruit business.
Now, the fruit business, we'll stop there. We'll continue with that story. A little throwaway line, Billy is going to go and join the family fruit business. What do you got to say about that?
Well, the fruit industry is something that I've connected to since 1979. And my husband was the third generation in Sydney markets. We were in Haymarket to begin with, and then we went to Flemington. So we'd come in with our trucks to unload overnight. We had an orange farm and we'd be packing and come in. And where he'd normally park sometimes the truck, he'd say to me, can't park there, got to go up here. And I'd say, why not? And it was right outside our business, like where we were working. We weren't. And I said, well, we got to go up there for? Can't they move? He went, no, you don't touch them. Look at the people around it. The thugs had come. They were protecting the stock. So the leaf line seemed to be a line where the pot was hidden in. Coming into King's Cross. So, you know, the trucks had come, people would pick it up and it would go out. But it was all before the markets was even working. And we were only coming in with our own oranges to unpack and then go home.
Just after 9 o'clock, Bill Bayer started the sweetest walk of all, out of Silverwater Prison. Now sporting a small tuft of grey hair, the 55-year-old was all smiles. Having spent 15 years inside, the convicted drug dealer was in no mood to slow down.
Mr. Bayer, what have you learned from your time in prison?
He's got nothing to say in relation to what he's learned. He just wants to get on with his life, and I know all of you will respect him and his family's wishes.
Bayer's last walk as a free man was into the witness box of the New South Wales Police Royal Commission in 1996. He was questioned about his King's Cross cafe, the Cosmopolitan, but denied he was a drug dealer or bribed police. The commission then showed Bayer a surveillance video of him with narcotics. He was sentenced to 18 years in prison for conspiracy to supply commercial quantities of cocaine and heroin. Self-confessed corrupt police officer Trevor Haken told the ABC's Australian Story that he received large amounts of cash from Bayer to protect his drug dealing activities.
And he said, if anyone goes against me, I'll kill them. I'll kill their wife. I'll kill their kids. And that's not a threat I took idly.
Bill Bayer won't be returning to his former stomping ground or old habits anytime soon. His parole conditions include a ban on visiting King's Cross, a ban on gambling, and regular drug testing. His brother wants him to join the family fruit trade.
I'm very happy. I'm very happy for my brother come. Thank you.
Bayer's entourage made a hasty exit from the Silverwater prison car park. David Spicer, ABC News, Sydney.
I can't help but notice that all the gangsters in that story had big smiles on their faces, and even the lawyer that was talking, they all had big smiles. It seemed like a happy event, but it's also that smile of they're playing a game. So what can you tell us about Bill after all of this happened?
Okay. The links to Bill I had, right? So he came out of prison. Within 2 weeks, my first real death threat came, to the point that I was left very shaken and knowing that I was imminent danger.
What year was that, 2011?
11. I thought I wouldn't get out alive. And I knew Juanita Nelson had not gotten out alive. And she was doing 16 dossiers on people. And I started to think, but these 16 dossiers, these people must be dead. If you look at the age of Bill Bayer, he would have been like a youngish boy in King's Cross. He might have been just a runabout at the time. But he actually links into the security of Frank Thiemann down on Victoria Street for the building. And if you go back through the research, he was the bodyguard. He was the head security guard for the Pink Pussycat Club.
Wow. So the links are there. And, you know, interesting in that Bill Bayer story, all the black Mercedes and BMWs and the brother looking very happy. You know, you could say you've seen mafia movies, Italian Hollywood-style movies, and the families, you know, Al Pacino, etc., looking the same sort of affect on the face. Bill's going back to the family farm, you know, in that real Italian style.
Ah, but then I actually wrote into the police. He was probably would have been 12 months out, and my husband had been in the markets 5 days a week, sometimes six, and not once had he seen Bill Bayer in there. And we wrote in about that because we knew that was correct. He never went to work at the family business. Now, that was part of his parole conditions. Who was checking up on him?
That might be why he's smiling as he left jail. But let's bring people back to King's Cross. And your observations are interesting. Now, this one is interesting. We're talking about black Mercedes, etc. You noticed around that time a black Mercedes parked in King's Cross. Tell us about that story.
Yes. Well, it was a period of time that I was going to King's Cross and walking the strip, and I'd walk up and down a couple of the streets. So Bayswater Road, Victoria Street, Springfield, down Roslyn Street, back of Kellett. So just a little bit. I actually was still quite scared, you know, and I tried to make sure I was on camera because I got told they could shoot me and not get caught.
So there's CCT cameras right up and down that street, and you knew where they were roughly, and you could stay in that camera range.
Yes, and I'd sometimes just catch the train and go in there. Sometimes I'd meet my Alex. And
you noticed the park. You and Alex noticed a parked black Mercedes.
So I noticed the Merc before him. So I noticed this Merc, and it was parked with the number plate Alex. And it wasn't a brand new Merc, but it was a couple of years old. And it was in a 1 hour park.
Empty. No one in it.
No, but it was opposite the brothel. So it was just a bit. And because the number plate was Alex, I went, oh, there's an Alex Bayer. Oh, I'm wondering whether it's his. And I looked, no disabled parking. So why wasn't there a whole heap of book tickets on it? Because the brown bombers walk around there. So I started to look at it. So then within a week I went back and it was still there in the same spot. And I went, oh, no, this is ridiculous. They've got cameras on this strip. They've got the brown bombers walking up and down.
Maybe and the for the those that don't know, the brown bombers are the local name for the parking inspectors, parking police. Go on.
Yeah. So I saw it there, and then I thought, well, I'll write to the police. It's under cameras, and they could watch it. So I wrote about it, and we had seen someone come to the boot of it one day between my visits and Alex's visits. So I put on it, you know, maybe you should look at the footage to see if anyone's going to the boot. Because
right.
the car was clean inside. There was nothing inside. There was no, it might have had a jacket on the back, but it was empty, right? And clean, right? So I thought, I'll write to it. I went back into town. So normally I'd send an email and then within 24 hours I'd go back to town to check. And the car got moved. And I went, oh, it's not there. So I sent the email to the cops and then the car got moved.
Where was it moved to?
Well, down at the bottom of Bayswater Road. So they mustn't have thought I'd walk that far because you've got to go right down. And it was like the last car park. And I actually went nearly that far down to see.
All right. Now, we threw up a couple of ideas around this fact that the police weren't that concerned about the car and the car moved. So we said, David Laidlaw, you mentioned him. What was the general reply that came back about the police tapes?
Yeah, well, David Laidlaw, he's chief inspector of cold cases, and he talked at the William Terrell case that he dismissed all the police surveillance tapes to go through. Now, William Terrell is a missing boy. Gary Jubaline, the detective at the time, thought these tapes were important, but he dismissed it. You know, but all they had to do was watch 24 hours, 7 days a week, maybe in 1 week, on Darlinghurst Road to pick up the drug dealer.
So we're talking about police surveillance tapes and, you know, there's probably a number of scenarios. Anybody that sat and watched police surveillance tapes is probably aware just how boring that can be. It's hour after hour after hour. And we thought, okay, you're being told as a concerned citizen the tapes aren't being looked at and you're being told that it's being dismissed. There's nothing there, nothing to see, like in the William Terrell case. This could be probably what we'd hear from politicians for budgetary reasons. We haven't got the manpower to watch all the videos. It could also be that other reasons like...
Okay, so budgetary reasons is one thing, and if you watch the drug network too closely, you'd pull them apart because of the alleged corruption money.
Well, that was the next point, where, you know, you might actually get a bit close to the big boys.
That are never exposed. And the big boys come into King's Cross because they're showing off. You know, but lately, I think since Sarah Budge's been in court, it's rare John Ibrahim comes. And he normally stays on Bayswater Road. He doesn't venture around into Darlinghurst Road anymore.
So, look, without seeing all those tapes, you mentioned Gary Jubaline wanted to watch all the surveillance but hasn't been allowed to, is that right?
Yes, well, Gary Jubaline had brought those tapes up, but he never watched it all either, or else he might have figured out he was on the wrong lead.
Look, when we hear things like this as concerned citizens, we think there's some sort of protection going on now. Why wasn't the car booked? You know, and, you know, not so many people out there doing your on-the-ground legwork.
I'll tell you, I actually got a good lead on a safe house that was moving all the drugs through King's Cross, right? It was down in Woolloomooloo. This was back in 2013-14. And I thought, okay, I went home and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I sent my email to only Andrew Scipione at the time. He was the police commissioner because I knew that they were moving, like, the queue up for people going into the house. And I knew it was someone, it was a two-story terrace, so there were two units. I'd been past it. I knew about the security, the cameras on the front of it. So I sent this email. I got back to Woolloomooloo to look at it. It was in Crown Street. It had a heap of traffic going past it. I got back there 6 o'clock in the morning. So I'd only done like 3 hours sleep turnaround. And the whole unit had been emptied. They were cleaning the windows, like with the blinds right up. Everything had gone. safe house moved. Wow. Only one email to Andrew Scipione got that. Now, this had been going on for months. The problem was I wasn't sure out of about five homes which one it was. But then when I got the lead, I went, oh, now I'm right. I've got the right one.
Well done, Jen. So, look, there's lots more stories for us to talk about, and we'll come back to this in the next episode, I think, because you mentioned the word Scipione. It's an Italian word linked similar to...
Well, my computer keeps changing it to scorpion, and it gives me a little tickle because the scorpion was the mark of the cocaine, and the scorpion's the logo of the King's Cross sting.
We'll leave it there, folks. Thank you for listening today. We'll be back shortly with another episode on the observations, research, and evidence picked up by this crime journalist, investigative journalist, all-round good citizen, who's out there using her own time to observe where police haven't got resources, to accumulate information where police have been told, don't look there. Years of research gone into her books. This one today, we're calling The Fall of the Cabal. And if you're interested in what is happening at the location of the infamous Pink Pussycat and Wayne Martin's once famous operation, well, go down Darlinghurst Road today and you'll find the building is still there. It's empty, nothing happening. And if anyone wants to do an investigative piece of work, start looking behind the name J.A. Hayek. It's a company name. J.A. Hayek. And we look forward to hearing more information about why the building's empty and who's behind J.A. Hayek. That's the name of our episode today, The Fall of the Cabal, The Rotten Fruit. From the fruit pickers, we've taken you to King's Cross and we've discovered some rotten fruit on the streets of Sydney. My name's Greg Kerr, and I'll be back next week for another episode of Whistleblowers.